It's Thursday, July 8th, 2010, and you're listening to episode 197 of Fear the Boot, a show about tabletop role-playing games and a little bit more. Running time for this episode is 1 hour and 7 minutes. Welcome to Fear the Boot. My name is Dan.
My name's Chad, and I have a burning question for Dan.
Oh, I've got
one for you.
I think
penicillin will take care of that.
I just have a burning sensation.
Go on, Wayne.
Look, this is Wayne.
This is Pat. I'm all flustered. I didn't announce myself right. My name is Pat.
And how is that different from how you did it the first time?
This is Pat.
There was a slight intonation difference, I could tell.
Uh-huh.
And this is K-Riss.
Who?
What?
Chris. K-Riss.
We've secretly replaced our Chris with K-Riss.
You know, so this episode, we have set up here on the topic list, the familiars and animal companion.
No!
Wonder it's already falling.
It's not going to happen.
Dead.
Pat, okay. I have never seen a sound wave do that. I just want you to know. But I just want to warn everyone going into this. If this episode fails to go anywhere, it's not our fault. We have no control over what we're about.
I think if this episode actually makes it to the air, it will burn the ears of all of our listeners.
Chris started this off right before we hit record by telling us something about his daughter that he is now going to have to confess on air. Chris, you're proud your daughter's reading. We are not. Go ahead and fess up what this child of yours that you are responsible for is reading.
Well, it's kind of funny because...
I'll get to it.
Just hold on a second. Because I am proud of her because she's reading. In fact, over her spring break during school, she read... And she almost finished. I mean, she got basically through all but half of the entire Harry Potter series. She crammed and she read that whole series over spring break, which is a pretty good feat on her part. And she really enjoys those books. But I think that she's been...
That's quaint. You're deflecting.
No, I'm getting there. It's just, I like to take the scenic route.
Yeah, he's trying to butter up the audience right now by saying, yes, well, she's reading these... good books, not really the
see, I'm trying to set the fact that she
the atrocity
at the core of it all is still a very good child, and everybody does, you know, make mistakes as they go through life. And so the other day I happened to be walking past our computer in the living room, and she was, you know, not on Facebook, and she was not doing Sims 3, and she just, there was basically a wall of text there, and I said to her, what are you reading? And she goes, oh, well, it's just, you know, and I checked to make sure she wasn't on 4chan, and so she's I'm just reading a story. I'm like, oh, really? What, you know, what is it about? And she got a little embarrassed, you know, just because she's 13 or 14 and she gets embarrassed. But then she finally confessed that she was reading, but although she did not use these words, but she's essentially reading Avatar, not Last Airbender, but the Na'vi, Pandora, Avatar fan fiction.
All right. And this led to a commentary on my behalf after we got past heaping shame upon Chris's household and his family name back for 100 generations. The point came up, a point of morality, that if I was stranded on a desert island with a little babe that I had to raise from near infancy into adulthood, and the only thing on this island with me was the Twilight Saga, this little bastard's growing up illiterate. That's just the way it is.
Amen.
Toilet paper or firewood?
Depends on touching my ass.
I'm not even sure it's worth burning.
Depends on whether I'm cold or puckering.
I didn't want to make fun of her, you know, because she's my daughter. And you don't want to make, you know, blatant fun of her and point to her and say, ooh, really?
You're not supposed to do that with your kids?
Well, no, you do, but only to a certain extent. And I guess I didn't want to discourage
Chris can't. We can blame parenting.
Yeah. Chris, and it's not a matter of making fun of her. This is very, very serious. I mean, it's a matter of being afraid for her mortal soul.
You're supposed to be protecting her from these kinds of predators.
Yeah, I used to think there were just one thing that a father was responsible for in terms of the daughter, you know, keeping her off the pole.
Absolutely.
Now I realize that Chris has found the other thing, keeping her away from fan fiction, Avatar fan fiction in particular.
It's time for an intervention. On Chris's parenting.
Yeah. I think this is almost tantamount to child abuse.
You know, I was talking to Dawn the other day, and she bought a whole bunch of mangas, was reading it, and I was walking by. I'm like, oh, what manga are you reading? She's like, oh, I'm reading Ouran Host Club, which is a girl sort of romantic high school manga. And she followed it up with, yeah, I have to get a couple of fanfics out for this. I got people waiting. Dawn has fans. Fanfic fans.
Wow.
Fanfic fans. Yes.
You know, and so I think that's part of the reason why I couldn't exactly judge her, because, you know, I've written essentially BattleTech fan fiction, and yeah, maybe I may have gotten paid for it, but yet at the same time, you know, I still am bouncing around and doing stuff in other people, in somebody else's universe. So
it's okay if you get paid for it. Is that what you're saying, Chris?
I think that if someone hires you to write it, who actually owns the IP, you're not ripping them off.
You're a professional author.
Yeah, I think that there's
a
definite.
Yeah, but what he was writing back and forth to Julie, that is fanfic.
And you know what? That's just one specific audience.
But that's acceptable because there's a female involved.
Well, it got him closer to getting laid, not farther from it, like most fanfic does. So here's the thing I want to know.
I am very fine with her being as far away from that as possible. So
let me tell you about the other great moral outrage that I have had that's been wrought upon me by Avatar, which is after the movie Avatar came out. I don't know if you guys saw this in the news or not, but this was a real thing.
I haven't even seen Avatar yet.
I haven't either. But this was real thing. I'm not making this up. There were groups that were getting together. They're forming psychological support groups to help people cope with the fact that Pandora is not a real place.
I saw that.
Where's my support group for Narnia?
That sounds like BS.
It is real. It is absolutely real.
It's real. I've seen it.
Yes. The reason I think it's fake, not that you're making up the news story or anything like that, but it sounds like that's something that a PR guy paid a couple of people $100 to say that they're doing the support group. It's just PR. It's just viral PR.
That's a planet where people plug their hair into animals. No one needs that to be real.
Yeah, that sounds ridiculous to me. Simply because, I mean, do they need a support group that's Star? I would believe that you need Star Wars support groups before that, because people are walking around thinking they're freaking Jedis.
Yeah, I've known people who need to be in a Star Wars support group.
And you don't hear about that.
Or a straight jacket.
And there will be 10 times more. This is, to me, I claim a bravacy arrow on this. Not saying that you are making this up or you didn't read this article. I'm thinking that this is just astroturfing.
You're calling shenanigans?
I'm calling bravacy arrow on this.
I buy it. And the reason I buy it
is because people are that pathetic?
Yes. Exactly. Because people get really caught up in fictional stuff because of the fact that, let's face it, there's a lot of things about the world that suck. And so it's real easy to get drawn off into some kind of fiction. So I totally buy it. Like I said, my facetious thing is I want to know where my Narnia support group is. You know, I've been devastated by that.
I picture all these people sitting around in a circle and they all have bandages on their foreheads because they're trying to crawl through wardrobes and hitting their heads.
I've been going up the dryer. I mean, the socks are going somewhere.
Yeah.
So, all righty.
Dan, I did say I had a burning
question
for you.
Yeah, you did. All right. So then we'll plow ahead with the real show. So
this came off of Dan's eclipse question of whether he would even bother with eclipse. So here's my question. It's an either or question, and none or will not is not an option. You have to pick one or the other.
Okay.
Even it's like God will force
you
to do this.
Are we playing Would You Rather, the podcast version?
Maybe.
Now we're going to F, Mary, kill.
So you are you're stranded on a desert island. You can either have the entire contents of fanfic.net, which is a huge repository of fanfic,
right?
Any genre you can imagine, right?
Yeah,
and not all of it's sex. It's just about anything.
No,
you can
right. And some of it's good. Most of it isn't.
Most of it isn't. Yeah,
I don't know. I've read some Saved by the Bell fanfic that was not very good.
surprise.
How come no one has a Chris's awkward confession over that one?
Because Chris has occasional things and the rest of it we make up. Wayne, you are a deep font. Chris is the stream behind my house. You are the f-ing Pacific Rim. I mean, it's...
Or the entirety of the Oprah book club.
I'm going to go with the fanfic, and here's why.
Okay.
Because there's a lot of crap in both, but at least with the fanfic one, there is so much diversity of subject matter and authors, I could probably sort out enough stuff to entertain myself. Whereas with Oprah,
she's going after kind of a... She does have broad stuff, but she is going after
some
demographic.
Yeah, there's some diversity to it. Yeah. But
like, you're not finding much sci-fi. Well, you're not finding much fantasy.
And it all has one thing in common, which is it's stuff that she likes and thinks her audience would like.
Yeah.
Whereas with fanfic, it could be anything.
Which I actually think the Oprah Book Club's a great thing. It gets, let's face it, middle-aged women who normally wouldn't necessarily...
Not going to go there.
Pat at fearthegroup.com.
Dang it. And what did he say? I missed it. I'm having trouble hearing him tonight. What did he say?
He said you're old. Go on.
So But it gets people like that who normally wouldn't necessarily read, reading. And reading some good books. I've read a couple of books off the Oprah Book Club.
Okay.
They were good books.
Yeah, Angela
I thought
Ashes,
Angela's
yeah.
Ashes was a wonderful book.
And then you get all the little pieces or whatever. And
well,
yeah. I'm going to have to agree with you, Dan, with the fanfic, because I read an Oprah Book Club book once and never have I had so much ire and vitriol and cascading burning hatred
read?
For a book as this piece of that I read.
What did you read?
I'm not going to say. You know why? Because I don't want anyone to go, oh, I'm just going to go out and read it just to see. It can't be that bad. It was that bad. And I hate it so much. I hate it to death.
Really?
I hate that book to death.
Yikes.
I wanted to burn the copy of the book that I had.
Wait.
I also wanted to go out and get all the other copies of it and burn it so no one else would read it.
You're either talking about The Fountainhead or The Great Gatsby.
No, those books were volumes better in comparison. The Great Gatsby is the literary masterpiece compared to this.
On our list.
It's not. I'm making fun of two books.
I say, read that in high school and I hated it.
Yeah, everybody hates it.
Okay, so let's pretend we do a podcast about something else. Gen Con 2010, of course, is coming up here in just a matter of weeks. I want to remind you guys once again.
Toph bitches!
Yes, the Toph bitches are out there. They are working their magic upon this convention. I actually just met up with all three of them. We went up to Fort Wayne, Indiana to see Mikey Mason perform. And I met with Necronomitron, Zeke Copperize.
What you bastards did to me? Do you know what you did to me?
Invited you and you refused to come?
You know what you did to me? You taunted me with my favorite beer.
No, Mikey taunted you with your favorite beer.
No, and then everybody else taunted me with the Shocker. Yeah. I saw the picture. I have the picture.
So while talking to these guys during this trip, I've come to find out we've got a warm-up dinner probably Wednesday night. They're looking at Scotty's Brew House, getting us some reserve space there. We've got Pathfinder games, Battletech games, Star Trek games, Diplomacy games, a sushi run. This is a rolling party you do not want to miss. There were a lot of people that were involved in this last year, had an outstanding time. If you're coming up to Gen Con, don't know a lot of people, or just want to meet some more people that are really cool, you want to get involved in this, at least get on the network and hear what's going on. Stop by, meet some of us, shake our hands, let us buy you a beer. And I will link in the show notes how to get to this. You go to conplanner.com/GenCon2010.
Have I mentioned that two people have challenged me? Thrown down the gauntlet that I have not yet picked up to run a Torchwood St. Louis game.
Gen Con would be a great place to do that.
I challenged you on the air to do it.
I know. You were the second person to challenge me to that. And I still have not picked up the gauntlet. I'm still mulling it over. I do have the Doctor Who role-playing game, so I can actually run it with rules now.
This is something I cannot endorse enough. If you are going to Gen Con, you want to get out there and get signed up for that and get on board with this. It's a great big rolling, role-playing, beer-drinking, board-gaming, sushi-eating party that starts on Wednesday and doesn't stop till Sunday. So get out there and get signed up for it so these guys know how to reach you. Related announcement, Con Planner itself is open to the public, and I've been out there adding some new features to it, fixing some bugs on it, going to keep doing that. But if you are running a convention or affiliated with a convention that's still struggling to do things on paper and spreadsheets, then get out there and at least give it a spin. Conplanner.com. It is completely free to use. There's nothing at all you have to do. Just get out there, sign up, get your con on there. This is something we just want to give to the community of gamers in general. And also, the way the site's built doesn't even have to be a role-playing con. It's set up pretty generically to run pretty much any type of event-oriented convention. Chad and Chris, you guys had a shout-out to give before we roll into our main role-playing topics.
Oh, yeah.
Cigar smoker, Kellum Sowers.
Man,
you know,
of men.
People send us a lot of emails, basically either questions or comments or saying they like the show. We also get the occasional, it's like, what the hell do you guys think you're doing? Yeah. We hate the show stuff, but that's not too many.
And we love them anyway.
Oh, yeah. No, we don't. But Kellum is the only person that we have ever had write us a handwritten fan letter. Handwritten, like not even typed out, not even printed out on like nice cardstock. Written with pen and ink by hand.
Yeah.
And thank you, man. Thank you for the cigars. Thank you for the kind words.
That's the other thing is he includes cigars. However, Chad,
shut up. Don't admit this. Shut up.
Well, you know, while you sit there and try and massage that out of Chad, I do want to say that not only does he do that with the handwritten letter, but he also he pays attention. He's very thoughtful. He wrote a little bit extra in there, and regardless of your feelings on the issue, my oldest son just graduated from high school, and in the package he sent me, he sent essentially a starter cigar for my son as a congratulatory gift for getting through high school. And even writing down there the fact that, you know, if you don't want him smoking, that's fine. I apologize for sending it then, but just, you know what, here's the gift anyway. And that's just an incredibly thoughtful man for doing that.
Was it nice when you smoked it?
Oh yeah, absolutely.
No, you totally made our 4th of July, man, because we lit these up and smoked them, and I'm 90% sure I gave Dan the correct cigar.
Okay. We'll just pretend that's the case.
Yeah.
So we got a question from a guy by the name of Robert who wanted to know what our opinion was on something. And this is something I want to kick around here a little bit.
I hate Shadowrun.
That actually would kind of answer this question, but I don't think you're going to like the direction it answers it. The question is this. If you look at role-playing game systems, you can very broadly and loosely put them in two piles, which is, on one hand, you have class-based systems, where when you pick up the rule book, there are 3, 5, 10, 15, 20, whatever, different things that you can be. D&D is the most obvious example. Star Wars is the same way. You can be a fighter, you can be a wizard, you can be a soldier, you can be a Jedi, okay? A class-based game. On the other side is stuff like Savage Worlds, MechWarrior, Shadowrun, where you do not have a specific class, but instead you simply have the raw points or parts of character creation, and you can cook to taste.
Shadowrun has archetypes, and they don't specifically tell you you have to play an archetype, but the archetypes are so integral to the story that everyone generally ends up playing
archetypes. I will withdraw Shadowrun because I agree with you, and I think if nothing else, they maybe fall somewhere in the middle.
Yeah.
Because, for example, to use magic, you have to avoid cybernetics, and so that does sort of create a weird, I don't know, like a pseudo-archetype system that... But anyway, so here's the broad question. Which one do you guys prefer and why?
Oh, I prefer to create my own from bottom up. I hate archetypes. I hate character classes because they pigeonhole you. It's this attitude that people come to it with of they don't say, well, I'm going to play a guy who is like this and is a fighter. They come to me and say, I'm playing a fighter who is like this. And it's just a priority skew to me. Now, I'm not saying
you think
that
the game creates that on some subconscious level, because I could do the exact same thing on a skill basis. I could graph Savage Worlds and predetermine that I'm going to play a space marine.
Sure.
And come to you and say, I'm going to play a space marine who's like this, versus saying I'm going to play a guy who's like this who also happens to be a space marine.
Well, if you play a game like D&D and you play just the core books, now I know they have splat books out the ass, but
right,
if you just play a core book, you're going to play a very specific kind of party. There's only so many choices depending on the size of your group. And it's just differences within that. I don't know. Like I said, I mean, you could have an absolutely wonderfully made character, and a character class isn't going to stop you from doing that. And you can have a totally classless system and a totally classless character, too. You know, the rule system isn't going to stop that. I just don't like the idea of having such limited choices, and even mechanically.
You're looking at a class-based system as limiting. Sometimes it just helps
it
you.
It is, because you can only play the classes they give you.
But if you already know what concept you want, sometimes that can help you build that concept. It gives you the framework around customizing as much as you want from there.
Are you talking about taking a class and changing the trappings around it? Because that's something different. That's actually, like, that's changing too much.
No,
you're no longer playing.
You come in and you know that you want to be the strong fighter. If you have a class-based system, you can look and say, okay, this is the classes that I'm going to start as that as my basis. And I think that's helpful
for
new players.
What I look at it as is we went into D&D, and we were playing the totally wrong system for this at the time. I went into D&D, and I wanted to play a bard, but I didn't want to play the singing, roguelike bard, jack of all trades. What I want to do is I want to play a storyteller. I want to go from town to town, telling legends, picking up new stories, entertaining people. And it's sort of a cross between a person who gives the news, a herald, a traveling herald, and a myth maker and a myth storyteller and stuff. And I had like lots of skills that were based on this. And in the edition that we played, which was the most current edition at the time, there was no class for that. I could not play that. I could not have a mechanical representation of that. We had to go into like three different splat books, combine all these different abilities through all these different ways, and I still didn't get what I wanted. Whereas I could take a system that doesn't have classes, and I could actually, like Savage World say, and I can construct something
as
like
long
that.
As you understand the system. From my perspective, I was wanting to play a bard exactly like you're describing. The one that goes around singing, the one that's the rogue, this, you know, basically exactly like you were describing you didn't want to be. And then you come into the system, and if the class is already set in the system, it helps you with a starting point.
Well, I prefer skill-based systems, and I'll explain why in a second. But let me give two defenses of the class-based system, which is why I don't totally write it off. Number one is, I think as Wayne described, it is good for new players.
Yeah, and don't get me wrong, I love both kinds of systems. I do see an advantage to both, too, though.
Right, and I don't think it's just good for new players. So don't anyone listening to this think I'm writing this off as, yeah, this is training wheels for role-playing. That's not what I'm saying. But I think it does help new players because sometimes it is very overwhelming to come in new to role-playing, and the idea that you can play damn near anything is very staggering.
Yeah, and when you try to put that together, you end up You could very well come up with something that's completely ineffectual for what you want because you don't know how to put it together.
But on the other hand, it goes the other way, too, where you go into a system and you can only play
And I'll get to that. This is why I prefer the more point or skill-based systems. But that is one purpose I think the class-based systems have or one advantage they have. The other is it does help with extreme issues of balance. Let's go back to Shadowrun as a point of discussion here. In Shadowrun, having magic or having cybernetics are very powerful things. And so they have to build in a mechanic where one effectively excludes the other anyway, as we said, almost recreating classes that were not intended to be in the game. And I think for something where you have a guy who has a wizard's abilities, a full D&D wizard's abilities, particularly once he starts climbing up in levels, you have to do some pretty severe things to put that within a context of the system, to balance that all out. And a class-based system allows you to do that without having gobs and gobs and gobs of, if you took this, then do this sort of adjustment rules to a more free-flow system. And so I think it does those two things outstandingly well. Now, at the end of the day, I personally would be willing to give away those two advantages for the freedom of a classless system because, like Chad, when I sit down at a game, I oftentimes have a character concept in mind that no class may perfectly represent. Now, in a given system, depending on the system, I might be able to take enough house rules or even built-in feats and adjustments and perks and whatever else and hammer out what I want. But it's always a long road. And
we're talking mechanical representation.
Yeah, but why do you need that, though? I'm listening to what you're saying, Dan, and I'm listening to what you're saying, Chad, and on a certain level, I do agree with you, but I...
Why do I need to be able to play whatever I want to play without the book defining for me what I have to play?
You could have taken any character class that you wanted, and you could have still played that character concept that you wanted in that fashion. And so what if the rules aren't there to do it? You mean to tell me that you needed a mechanical representation to allow you to carry news and be a storyteller? I mean, I'm being serious. I don't understand what you're saying.
That's the point of what we were saying, is that it went beyond that. Yes, I could play a guy who could travel from town A to town B, and I could deliver the news, and I can tell stories, and I could be a bard who can cast magic and pick locks and do all this daring do.
Not if you
and
don't
do all
pick
these...
any of those feats or abilities.
Whoa, time out. You're talking third edition.
I realize that oftentimes is a rope on this show I have repeatedly hung myself on, and Chad's getting the joy of it now, is that people start debating the tree instead of the forest.
The problem, though, is you're making it sound like if it's a class-based system, every character that falls under that class is a cookie cutter of another.
Mechanically,
I don't believe that to be the case. There's drastic differences.
But the mechanics allow you to just function within certain things within the game environment. Combat, general ability checks.
Social interactions.
Non-weapon proficiency checks, I guess, if you want to go back to 2E or some other representation. But I think concept of the type of guy you want to play, how you want to play that guy, is immaterial to either class or skill-based systems. I mean, skill-based, you can mechanically fine-tune it to have the mechanics match your concept, and it's easier to do that.
Here's what I'm trying to say, is that I have a character class, and I want the mechanics to represent what I'm trying to do. And I fully admit that in most class-based systems, they have rules for making your own character class. I totally admit that. But if you ignore that fact, and because we're just talking about character classes, you're saying that I can make any concept that I want to make, I can choose any character class I want to do to push that forward.
Well, and I think,
without changing the concept of the character.
Let me throw another. And that's what I'm saying, and it's going to vary from class to class. You're not going to be able to get 100% representation mechanically of what you want conceptually. You won't, and I totally admit that you definitely will not. You'll get
you can
close
in a lot of class-based systems or class-less systems.
You'll get close to varying degrees, but you won't get it exact. Absolutely, you will not get it exact.
Let me throw another thought into this mix. As I'm sitting here in my head running through the various games I know that are class-based, they all seem to have one thing in common. And maybe not universally so, but certainly the vast majority of them, this is true. They are all based on recreating a particular kind of story, whether it's the Fellowship of the Ring, whether it's Star Wars, whatever you want to talk about. There is some kind of story that either everyone commonly knows coming into it, or is at least something that you could give people a sense of what this is, what the story archetype is beforehand. And the point of classes is to basically put people into the roles that are necessary to recreate that kind of story. And the point that Chad's making, well, I may disagree with him on some of the little nuances of how he's making the point. I see where he's coming from, and I basically agree with him. Which is the limitation this creates is if you want to play something that is outside of those intended roles, you now suddenly have to do a serious amount of house ruling, or even not house ruling, you have to drag out a bunch of optional rules or splat rules, or you have to get into, depending
on
the system,
do a lot of, yeah,
like multi-classing, or to the point that you're really no longer playing a class anyway. I mean, you've effectively mutated it to the point you might as well have created it from scratch anyway. And so for the purpose of discussion, I'm not going to bring that to the table, because if you're effectively creating a class anyway, it kind of makes the debate between class versus non-class irrelevant.
And
so,
then I don't think it's a valid argument either to say you take a class that you're not going to mutate, you're not going to change like that, and all you're doing is you're taking everything. The class is mechanically how it is on paper, and that's fine. It's as close to your concept as you can get it, and you're just going to change the trappings of everything else. To me, that you might as well play Savage Worlds then, because Savage Worlds is all about changing trappings.
Well, not just Savage Worlds, but I mean any number of
games.
Yeah,
you could do any game
and
like that.
I just came up for me recently, and I'm going to hang myself from a tree as opposed to the forest here. But this just came up for me in a Star Wars game that I'm playing with John. I wanted to play a guy who was an ex-assassin for the Empire, but he was not an assassin in the bounty hunter sense. He didn't walk into a bar all badass and shoot.
You're not the assassin character class.
Yeah, he was more the tuxedo assassin. He would fit in with high society. Well, a lot of those skills and trappings fell under the nobleman class, but he was still pretty good with a gun or a brick of explosives when he needed it. Well, that kind of fell under soldier, but he could kind of bypass some security systems, and that really fell under the scoundrel class. And all of these abilities, and I'm not going to get into the details of it, but the way I balanced this out, I wasn't trying to play a character to do everything. I was trying to play a character who was something like the more brutal forms of James Bond, the Daniel Craig sort of James Bond, the tuxedo killer. And there were many things he could not do. There were a lot of things a nobleman had he was not capable of. There were many things a scoundrel had he was not capable of. But the point is, at the end of the day, at first level, I could not create this character. I had to find a character class that was kind of close and just really pretend my way to where I wanted to get, because of the fact that this character did not exist in Star Wars. And therefore, when they went to create a Star Wars role-playing game, there was no interest in creating the tuxedo killer.
Do you know how many character sheets you are going to get emailed with your character on it?
Well, but in my point being, even once again, and what I want to stress is, even if you disagree with us on any of the trees, that's fine. But the point of the forest, I mean, let's focus on the forest, is that if you have an archetype or class-based system, you can play 5, 10, 15, 20 different things. You cannot play something completely generated from scratch without ruling it to the point that you might
with
as well
a class,
play a class system anyway.
With a class, something in some way, either very, very narrowly defined where it almost doesn't matter, like a fighter, or something that is very, very broadly defined, like a hacker or a mage in Shadowrun or something like that, something is defined for you out of the gate. And that you either have to roll that into your concept or you have to change the trapping of to make that work with your concept.
When we were talking about the game we're playing right now, I'm looking at it in the concept I want perfectly fit the Bard. That's sure. what I wanted to play. I'm looking at Savage Worlds, and I don't know how to recreate Bardic knowledge in Savage Worlds. I'm sure there's a way to do it, because you've talked about how you can do anything in there. But I'm looking at all of these skills that are inherent to the class that I wanted, and I didn't know how to recreate those over in Savage Worlds.
Yeah, Wayne, you've touched on what I've been thinking this whole time, what these guys are talking about, what they're talking about. And to me, I think they're maybe a little off base of what the original part of the topic was really trying to get at. Because to me, it's more like you guys are talking about the backstories of your characters as opposed to really, am I playing a predefined class or am I going to make up my own class, as it were, in a class, you know, in a classless system with just using the skill points. But anyway, the way I look at it is a class-based system really allows you to get down into much finer detail, into very specific, defined traits and abilities and this, that, and the other.
But I don't want the game to define.
I know you don't, but some people do. And then, but on the other side of it, if you do the like a skill-based system, you're able to sort of flesh out the little bit of this, that, and the other that you want to do, just like your assassin character that you mentioned, Dan. You can do that, but what I find is that with those skill-based systems is it's much more of a median character, and by that I mean it's you stay closer to the middle of the road, or you know, sort of a nucleus of abilities, and you don't branch out to the extremes, because you really can't, unless you're really good and you decide, I'm going to be the best marksman. And you put all your points into shooting, and then you can go out on those extremes maybe. But really, when you start picking and choosing this, that, and the other, because you want to do a little of this, a little of that, and a little of the other, which is kind of what bards are. I mean, that's the sort of the bard thing of the jack of all trades. That's what you get into with the skill based systems. I do like both. I think I may tend more toward the class systems, just because, again, like I said, I think with a class system, you are able to get into some of the specific well-defined abilities that are going to be unique, say, to that class, that you're just not going to be able to recreate in a skill-based system. Certainly Savage Worlds. I struggle with Savage Worlds, because the way I look at it is this. You take Savage Worlds and sit down and try to make, say, a bard or a paladin, a hacker or whatever it is in some of the sci-fi games. Mm-hmm. You can do it. To me, it's sort of a 50% now, type of a thing.
I'm just sitting here smiling because now I'm thinking of all the Savage Worlds fans who are going to flood Pat
and that's fine.
Email box.
That's fine. You know, and Savage Worlds is one example. Yeah. Heroes system is another one. Yeah, but you know, it's
oh my god, you did not just go Heroes.
I did because I played it. And, my god, and that's fine. I still stand by it. You can put those points into it, and yes, you may be a veteran player of it, and you know exactly how to min max all this and do this, that, and the other, but still, I don't believe that you're going to be able to sit down and come up with the exact same powers that you would have as if you try to recreate classes in that system, like, you know, the established classes from another system using heroes.
I like both, and like we said, I'll play anything. I'll give anything a try.
That's right.
You slut.
I'll give anything a try. But from my personal perspective, you know, Chad, I know you feel very limited by class-based systems.
I feel very limited by
I feel very overwhelmed. Rules. I feel very overwhelmed by class-less systems. I don't know how to create what I want to create unless I've played it a few times. So I sit down in front of it and I feel lost, which is why I like the class as a template. I don't feel restrained by it at all. I see that as my starting point. And from there, I can do whatever I want.
I'm on the opposite side of where you're at, Wayne, that I generally cut down the middle on that. I'm fine with both. I don't resent either side, but if I had to pick between the two, I would go to the classless side.
I really
if
was,
I had to pick I I'd probably pick whoever would as well. Has a better story, whichever GM is running a story. I don't care what system they're on.
I really want the mechanics of the game to define as little about my character as possible. To me, the mechanics serve 90% of role-playing games. The mechanics serve one purpose, and that is combat and killing.
Have we overrun the pet topic yet?
Nope.
Have we killed it?
Damn it.
No.
Damn it.
In fact, here we go.
Our discussion / argument aside, Chad, I totally get what you're saying. And from what I know of you and everything, Godspeed, man, go and get and do what you want. But
I will.
In the situation that you're talking about, I think that a class-based system where you can't exactly get what you want, and this seems to be like some sort of reoccurring theme for me, but That type of situation, honestly, I think presents you, the player, and even the GM in the case, with role-playing opportunities that I think would really and actually end up enhancing the game and probably make you enjoy that character better, because the fact that you wanted to be this type of person, but yet you had to choose that right there creates a great role-playing hook that is going to enhance your character and give you some good opportunities to either have some great success along the way or have some spectacular failures, which will really end up enhancing the game. It's going to make the game ultimately better because of the fact that those restrictions are in place.
We are finally going to attempt something. I'm going to watch my computer go up in flames while we do this. The Familiars and Animal Companions.
Ow, my eye!
Let's start by defining what it is we are talking about, setting some boundaries for discussion. What we're talking about is taking a certain subset of non-player characters within your game and making them diverse, interesting, and memorable characters. And that specific subset of NPCs we're talking about are bestial companions that have intelligence ranging from animal level to near human. All right, once you hit the point of full human cognition, you're a human in a dog's body, that's a totally valid type of character. That's not what we're talking about. What we're talking about...
Would that be like a fighter or a bard?
It'd be like a barbarian.
Yeah, it'd be like a barbarian, absolutely.
What we are talking about here is stuff like the wizard's familiar, the druid's animal companion, getting out of D&D. I don't know. You're playing the Fallout role-playing game, and dog meat starts following you around.
You're Mad Max's dog from the Road Warrior.
Yeah, something like that. We're talking about something that is not a human trapped in an animal's body. It is specifically an animal, though I do accept in some cases, depending on the game or the setting, the animal may exceed its typical intelligence by some degree. All right, so let's start with the first matter of discussion here, which is, who do you give control to? Does the player have control over this, or does the GM?
It's shared.
Care to explain that?
Oh, I was waiting for your little explain. Normally you throw those one of those right back in my face when we start, but yeah, no, I think it's a shared thing depending upon the circumstance of who and when it suits best, because obviously this animal is going to be more likely trained to a certain degree, and so in that sense the player is going to have that level of control over it, where, you know, my dog's going to be at my side. If I'm going to make sure that I give my dog commands to stick by me, or I'm going to have him, you know, help me scout or something like that. The player can direct control of that animal to a certain extent. Conversely, of course, when there is unknown danger, when it's the person behind the screen, or in Chad's case, a person at that end of the table, who knows what's really going on and the player has no clue what's going on, then the GM's got to take control, because that animal is, like we said, is still an animal and is going to react thusly despite the fact of any kind of training or any control that the owner is going to have over it. And so at that point, or in other certain circumstances, then the GM's got to take that control away. Use it as either some sort of plot device or use it as the circumstances dictate.
I actually look at animal familiars just like I would any other NPC. And by that, I mean that the GM should be the one that controls their actions. Now, I think what you were sort of getting at, and the only place where I would think that the PCs would sort of control what they do is, say, in a combat situation. And for me, that's just like any other NPC, where the players around the table will sort of have somewhat control over what the NPCs are going to do in the combat. But ultimately, it's the GM that's going to decide and sort of roll out what they do. And I think that's the way it should be.
I'm with Pat on this one. And here's why. Because I really don't think they are, exactly as Pat said, any different than any other form of NPC. Because you may be able to issue orders to them. They may have some loyalty to you. But so would an intelligent player character. But at the end of the day, the fact is, these things are still going to make their own decisions for their own reasons. Now, this presumes we're not talking about something you do have total control over. If we're talking about something
like mind-controlled dog.
Yeah, if you have something that you've mind-controlled, or you have something
that...
Oh,
I was just being facetious. But yeah, I guess you could have a mind-controlled dog. Yeah,
or you have something that you've summoned or whatever. Yeah. I realize that's a different framework. But if we are talking about something that still has its own independent will, I would not give control to the party. And in fact, I have found it as a bad idea to do so for two reasons, and we'll probably come back to these in greater details as we develop this. But number one is because a lot of times the players will abuse it, that they will use it for a variety.
I've never seen that.
Oh, yeah.
No, I'm serious. I have.
You may not recall the game.
I have run games before, and I think that players should have control over their pet.
You don't remember Alex's Wild Kingdom.
Oh, come on. 16 years old.
Yeah, my point being, you've seen this abuse.
16? We were 16 years old.
How many 30-year-olds do you know that act like 16-year-olds?
Yeah. Come on. You cannot judge.
I got some more recent.
No, here...
Raising your hand like that, Pat, really helped on the mic.
I know it did.
I've got some more that are more recent that we'll come back to. But the other reason is this.
It's entertaining. I mean, that's why I think it's a good thing. I have been in games where I've controlled my own pets, and I've run games where the players have controlled their own pets. And you know what? It's fun. Who cares? I mean, as long as the player's not controlling a herd of fire-breathing war elephants, how powerful can it possibly be?
Here's the thing, though, and it's actually interesting that for once you're jumping to the combat, whereas I'm going to the role-playing, because it's not a balance issue that concerns me. It's actually a role-playing thing. The reason that I would not give, in most situations, I wouldn't say never, but in most situations, a player control over multiple player characters is because each one of them will be played and developed half as well. You know, if I put an NPC with the party, I can give him his own personality. I can have him interact with the party. He has his own
goals. And a player can do all of these things with a pet, too.
He has his own goals and desires that may conflict with what the player wants. And as a GM, there's a lot of hilarious, entertaining, compelling, sad.
You know, I've heard your stories about how you abuse people with pets. And honestly, funny at first, but like incontinent rats and judgmental toads. I mean, the first few games, that's fun, but I would find it really annoying.
Yeah, but you're presuming that's all that I do, which is not the case at all. But, you know, my point being that just like you can make any NPC interesting, I don't think the fact that they're furry and have four legs now suddenly means not worth the GM's attention, all the players.
No,
I think you can make a fascinating, compelling character.
I think that they should be
animals.
The players, though, not because the GM, that they're uninteresting or whatever that you just said. I think that it should be the players because it's the player's pet. If this was some dog that is following them around,
if
that none
I hire
of the players...
a mercenary, would you give me total control of him?
Yes. Yes, I would.
I would not.
I wouldn't either. I mean,
I am not afraid of what you would do with it. I don't think you would ruin my game. I think it would be great. If you want total control of that mercenary, if you write that into your character and you come to me and you want that, sure, I'll give that to you.
You're pressing a fear motivation here. It's not a fear. I have seen it abused, which I'll come back to. But once again, that's not the only motivation here. It's that I think there's a great opportunity to create a fascinating recurring NPC out of this character. And
that you can control just as much as I can. And as much as I can make it entertaining and wonderful and great because I'm such a wonderful GM person, you, because you're such a wonderful player, can make that as well. Dan, you've written a novel. You've written a novel, and your novel is filled with characters, multiple characters. You did not focus on one character and have all the others be shallow. I know that all the players I work with have the ability to make multiple characters really interesting at the same time. A mercenary? Sure, you know, we can debate this because he has a personality. He can talk. He's a human being.
Right.
A dog has a personality. You know, everybody knows I'm not really a pet person, not into that, but I do know animals have personalities, they have emotions, and they can actually be pretty deep. But I do think that a player can make an interesting character, make a great background, and also play that character with an NPC character, with a dog or something, and have that go through. I've done it before. I've had my players do it before, and it's great. There's this great one where Phil, he was playing a druid of all things that burned a forest down, and he had a dog. He wrote into his character
Phil's in his internal consistency. Not in his characters, him.
It was a great plan. Somebody had run up a tree, and he was trying to get out of the tree, so he was burning it down. And we could not impress upon him why that was a good plan, yet really, really dumb.
This because would be like if Hiroshima and Nagasaki was actually just a double assassination.
Yeah, exactly. And so he's trying to burn this tree down. I mean, this is kind of the level we're talking about.
All right.
But he had a dog. And he would do what you say, the bad things of what you would say. He right. would send it into combat for, is there a trap down that hall? I don't know. Fido, go check it out. I mean, that's the kind of stuff that he would do. And we were all like, you're a druid. You love this dog. What is your problem? And so my character, who had absolutely no interest in animals, and I have no interest in animals, and I used to think animal companions for PCs were dumb because I'm not an animal person. All right, so that never comes through in my characters. My character, I just started role-playing with it. And I started like the GM was controlling it because Phil was only using it to spring traps. And I started throwing it potatoes. We were in a tavern and I had these potatoes and the tavern was famous for its potatoes. And the GM just had the dog walking around. I said, I flipped one to it. And the GM described it and it was kind of fun and funny. So I did again. I started interacting with the dog. And then over the course of several games, the dog... GM-controlled dog, again, because Phil was right. being Phil, GM-controlled dog, the dog started liking me more and more. Like, Phil would call it over, and the dog would look at me. And it would
but be here's all the question.
And
Chad,
then, eventually, I took over the dog, and I controlled the dog.
You've just made Dan's argument, though.
Yes, that's
how
what
could you have done
out.
Any of that if Phil were controlling
yes,
the dog?
Yes, exactly.
Which is fine. You know how I could have done that if Phil were controlling the dog? He and I talk about it. He and I make that arrangement.
Yeah, and okay, and I'll grant you that. I'll grant you that there are people out there.
Or there's a consensus who, where Phil actually pulls his head out of his butt and says, I'm a dog. I'm a druid who's abusing his own dog. Maybe he doesn't like me anymore. But we know that's not going to happen. So, yes, I do see your point in that.
Personal standpoint, though, it would be pretty common for me to want a pet as part of my character just because I am a pet person. I don't want to roleplay with myself, that pet. Now, if the pet is a major part of my character, I don't want to just have it run by someone else either. That's where I'm kind of splitting the difference between the two of you. If it's a major part of my character, I want a lot of input in this and what it does. But when it comes time to roleplay with it, it's much easier for me if I have mm-hmm. someone else controlling it. Otherwise, I'm just sitting there talking to myself.
Well, what it does, Wayne, is it gives you, and this was kind of my point too, is that it can give you things to play off of. If the GM's going to throw things at you in the shape of an action that your pet does, that's going to give you something to react to. More so than what it would be if you were running the show. I mean, yeah, certainly you're going to have your own little library of things that you're going to be able to do and do things that benefit the party. But in your particular case, and you as a PC, when the GM has something your pet does, it's going to affect you directly and give you something to do.
You know, I have to say that in support of Dan and Wayne's argument on this, I have to say to me, the biggest danger of a player controlling his own pet is something that you hit on is role playing with yourself.
Yeah.
You know, and it's bad enough if you're playing two characters who are talking to each other and it's like Sally and Bob. So, Sally, you want to go to the movies today? And you switch over. Why, yes, Bob. Yes, I do. Okay. And then you have this 5 minute.
I'll tell you.
10 times worse if it's, hey, Fido, you want to go over there? Bark, 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 bark.
I'll tell you right now, as a GM, there is one of the internal tricks I have learned through years of GMing is how to guarantee the players never in a game encounter two NPCs conversing with each other for more than a few seconds. Because holy crap, do I feel like an idiot
yes.
talking to myself
yes,
and trying to change voices when I'm not a stage actor. Mm-hmm. And I can kind of clown through it, but I generally try to get around it. Real quickly, though, the one way in which I have seen them repeatedly abused, and I'm not saying that every player would do this or this is the open and close reason why you should never allow them to be PC controlled. But I'm just saying that I have seen this is the animals are treated without any sense of attachment or care. Now, maybe in some situations that's appropriate, but in most situations where you have someone who has a pet, has a familiar, has an animal companion, that is not appropriate. This is something that you have an emotional bond with. In the case of a familiar, you have some kind of supernatural communion with. And yet I cannot tell you how many people I have seen treat these animals exactly like you described, Chad. Mm-hmm. Does this hallway have a trap? Don't know. Let's send Fido yeah. down and see what happens. I had a game where a guy was playing a wizard who had a bird familiar, and I finally at one point killed it mm-hmm. because it was constant. This thing was just his disposable eyes in the sky. It didn't matter what the danger was. His answer to everything was, I'm sending my bird ahead to scout. I'm sending my bird ahead to scout. Finally, there was a point there in these woods. There was an orc army nearby. I'm sending my bird to circle around it and see how big it is. And I'd had enough of this crap. And I don't know how many times I'd stop and said to him, Mike, this is a familiar. Mike, this is a familiar. Mike, this is a familiar. Stop treating it this way. Just grabbed 3d20s, threw them out on the table. One of them came up a 20. I rolled the damage. Your bird just got killed. Why would they shoot my bird down? Two reasons. One, they're orcs. They're hungry and violent all the time. And two, they've got their own shaman and medicine men. They know what a familiar is.
Yeah.
But here's the thing. I don't think that always has to be the case, provided you can trust the person to role play with a sense of attachment, appropriate attachment to that animal. And I do realize, depending on the situation, that level of attachment may vary. But I mean, familiars in particular is the big one. The druid.
Yeah.
Who ought to love animals, doubly so his own.
Yeah, that is the poster child of how not to do it.
Even outside of that, I realize if we look through history, for example, if we go back to like the Napoleonic era, it was not uncommon for people to jump off their horses and use them as cover.
Oh, yeah.
But at the same time, look, we humans, we love to give anthropomorphisms and anthropopathisms to everything. We love to make everything around us human. You know, people talk about their cars having attitude problems and such. And in the same way, let me take a different person from that same era, George Washington, who was extremely fond of one horse and used it for the majority of his career because he was completely attached to it. This is not a man who, if he was in D&D, would have sent his horse down to spring the traps.
Right.
You know, my first car was named Kit. And I actually, when the car was broke, I would get physically ill. So I can't see myself actually having an animal. Go with your horse idea there.
52 shows, 52 weeks, and I didn't think that we could do 52 awkward confessions.
Oh,
I'm wrong,
sir.
I
had no doubt. I had no doubt because when we first got that from Nick, Wayne's like, I don't know if I'll ever use it. I don't have any more. And I'm like, yes, you do. Wayne, I have so much faith. A man who spent his childhood doing basement wrestling, there is no bottom to this abyss. We will be digging it and mining it for the rest of the show's run. All right, let's talk real quick about what you can do to make animals interesting. And I'd like to start by reiterating...
Feed them potatoes.
Something, well...
I love that dog. Do you want to know what happened to that dog? Do you want to hear a gaming story? Do you want to know how the dog
was? I don't know if we do, but a lot of other people do.
I'm sure. So my character was a chaotic good necromancer.
Okay.
And it was sort of the Leonardo da Vinci digging up bodies and figuring out how the human body works and figuring out how life works. It wasn't the death thing, it was life thing, but studying life through death.
Right.
Sort of thing. But he's digging up bodies, so he's chaotic good. Eventually, I liked this dog so much that I worked out with the GM that he would become my familiar. The big bad of the story is a super powerful necromancer.
So he was your familiar and Phil's animal companion. This is a lecherous little dog.
Well, come on. I treated him right. He knew where his bread was buttered. The big bad of the game was a huge, gigantic necromancer who was actually trying to transfer his soul into a dragon skeleton to become a sort of Draco-lick sort of weird thing. We were hunting him, and he knew we were hunting him. So what he did is he hit his phylactery. He turned my character into his phylactery. And so to kill him, the party would have to kill me. And after a very, very hard choice, I figured out what to do. The familiar was an actual magical spiritual soul connection, an extension of me. I could transfer the phylactery because I was a necromancer to the dog, and then I could kill the dog. For a week, I had to figure it out. Do I want to let them kill me and let the dog live, or do I want to do this and kill the dog? I really didn't know which one I would do until the night of the thing.
You know, I have such issues with animal abuse in any story. I would have sacrificed my own character to keep the dog alive.
I didn't. I killed the dog.
I'm not surprised.
Here, though, I think is the heart of the issue, which is the best way you can make an animal really bring something to the game is to treat them like you would any other NPC. To give them a sense of motivation, to give them a sense of...
It was more like...
To give them a sense of personality, to do something that it's more than just the base archetype. I mean, if anyone has ever owned a pet that they were actually attached to, you start to realize that these animals, even within the same breed, have distinct personalities, have distinct quirks. There are things that make them different. You could have three golden retrievers in your house, and they are not the same dog. know, these are all radically different individuals. They're not human, but they do, in the literal sense of the word, have personhood. And this is where, Chad, your thing earlier about the incontinent toads and such, where this came from was, as I've said many times, one of my favorite charts in all of random chartitude throughout role-playing-dom
and all kinds of other...
Is there's
you've got chartitude.
Is the personality
we vacationed there 1 year. It's really, really great.
Is the personality quirk table in the third edition DMG. It's a great place to give random personality traits to an animal. And they don't have to be annoying or comedic. Mm-hmm. Those traits could be things like loyalty, honor, whatever. I don't know. You can come up with anything, but they don't always have to be over the top annoying. But you can go beyond that. You can give them their own motivations and history. Now, depending on the level of intelligence, these, of course, may or may not be super complex, but there may have been something that these things have been through, some history they had. Wayne, a great example we gave for this is in the Apocorisos game. You had an alien animal that
of some sort
that you called Smiley, did not know what it was, and had left it to me to basically throughout the campaign develop where this thing came from and how you ended up with
it. Yeah, my concept is basically as we were a salvage crew and I found this thing on a ship, had no idea what it was. I was looking it up, trying to figure out what it was, no clue. And I was giving you that hook that you could do anything with, essentially.
Yeah, and I had several thoughts in mind. The campaign didn't live long enough for any of them to occur.
Oh, it would have been a chest burster by the end of the campaign.
But, you know, it could have been the last of an extinct kind, or, I mean, there's all kinds of things that I could have done with it to give it its own motivations, to give it its own background. And once again, it has an animal intellect, but I still treat it with the same care and the same attention that I would any other NPC. Yep.
And I had some great role-playing moments, not only with that, that generated role-playing moments with Chad, as he put as he put in my mind that the character was in danger, and I was keeping it a secret from the crew. So just having this thing and having it have its personality added role-playing moments with everybody else in the group.
And my character didn't give Wayne's secret away because it had the potential to annoy the piss out of the commander.
There are two things, though, I think the game master has to be careful not to do in the process. One is you cannot have something that's constantly stealing the scene or constantly the focus of the game. Like any other NPC, it's just an NPC. Or even if it's player-controlled, look, still some dude's dog. It's still some dude's familiar. This should not be constantly stealing the scene. It should not be the crux of the plot. It's just as annoying as any other Mary Sue NPC or PC retainer could put out there.
If you have a main character and it's PC-controlled, and your PC-controlled dog is more interesting than you are,
you're doing it wrong.
Yeah, you're doing it wrong. It's time to rethink the character, Lil.
And the second caveat I would put on there is if the GM is going to control the animal, if you fall on that side of our little debate here, you must do so without breaking trust. You know, look, if somebody pays the money to get a trained warhorse, or they have an animal companion or a familiar or even just a dog they've taken really good care of, there are varying levels of control and loyalty that that animal is going to have towards that character. But if you are constantly using that animal to be a jackass, to be an obstacle, to be an endless annoyance, that's wrong. In some games, that character class is balanced around the presumption you have that ability. And if the GM is constantly hamstringing that ability, it's like telling the fighter every third round his sword is choosing not to attack. I mean, it's that sort of crippling thing. And it's just, it's an annoyance and it's a violation of trust. And all you're going to do by doing that is discourage your players from playing certain types of characters or involving animal NPCs in the game, because all you're going to do is be a jackass with them. And even in the case of the stories Chad was talking about, where I had familiars with irritating quirks, they were always kept within check so that, yeah, they were annoying, but it was always in comedic moments. It was never the wizard really needed his familiar, and instead of helping him out in appropriate ways, it was just sitting in his bag, taking a dump all over his spell book.
Although that is really funny.
And when they were treated with appropriate levels of respect and care, they were very helpful and willing to do things on behalf of the party and willing to take some risks.
Let me ask you guys some practical questions about animals, especially familiars. The larger, more intelligent animals, whether it's GM-controlled or player-controlled, it's pretty easy. You've seen a dog, you know what a dog's like, dog runs around. What do you guys do when it's a smaller or stranger animal? Like, a bird or a frog. How do you make a frog interesting? I own two frogs. And let me tell you, they just sit there.
I think it's a self-fixing problem, and here's how. If the animal, let's take a frog as an example. Yeah. If it's a familiar, it's no longer just a frog anyway. It now has an intelligence that's creeping above frog-level intelligence, and therefore can take on personality traits it wouldn't otherwise
have.
It's
hard to go below frog level.
If it is just a frog, frogs by their nature are not social pack creatures. They're not going to socialize with you. It really is just a frog. You're more attached to that frog than it is to you. No, plain and simple.
My frogs love me.
But when your frogs aren't there, they look longingly at me.
You give that that frog a top hat and a cane, then you got something.
Hello, honey. Hello, banana.
So I think I love it when you use an old man voice. It's so ironic.
You sound so much younger.
Here's another big one that I have always struggled with. How do you make a horse interesting? 90% of the games that people tend to play are fantasy.
You want the simple answer to that?
How do you turn them into... In most games I've seen them, they are inanimate.
They're motorcycles.
They're motorcycles. Yeah. They're inanimate. To be honest with you, motorcycles have more personality.
Yeah.
I could describe how cool my motorcycle looks and the sounds it makes and leaning
into
the turn.
You want to know what's helped me a lot? And for some people, they may not even have to do this research. Talk to somebody that's raised horses. And really sit down with somebody that's raised horses or is currently raising horses. For example, right now, Christian, not Zeke Copperize, but the one that I work with, he grew up on a farm where they raised horses. I'm friends with a guy named John. Once again, not John Grant, a different John, not involved with the podcast. But his parents have a horse rescue. And you sit down with them and you start asking about the different horses they've had, the appearances they've had, the personalities they've had. And you start to get an insight into what horses are like. I think the disconnect for people like you and me, we're suburban boys. Mm-hmm. We know all about dogs and cats. Mm-hmm. We don't know jack about horses.
Yeah. Well, and you're right.
You've ridden a horse.
Yes, I've ridden horses many times.
So I grew up with horses too. And honestly, what you can say about a horse is just think of a horse as a very, very big dog. And that's along the lines of really what is the difference there, the disconnect that you're going to get in role play. I mean, when you think about it, because, your horse is your mode of transportation. What you don't get is
a horse jumping on my chest and knocking me
down. Exactly. You're also not going to have the horse
following
you.
Thinking the exact same thing.
You're also not going to get the horse following you into the tavern and sitting under the table while you eat dinner. It's not going to curl up by your fire. What's it going to do? It stays in the stables until you're ready to go to the next town. And even in modern times, that's really what horses do. A lot of people that own horses, say in the city, they have them stabled at a place and they go see them on the weekends or something.
I don't
something.
Know, man. Talking to some people race horses.
Well, and that's
they
different.
They have had clingy horses.
Well, yes, and they do have personality. Like I said, they're just like a big dog. They have personality just like dogs will. They're very loving creatures. They really are, but they're big.
Let me ask you this. Do you guys want to see in a role-playing game all your horses, the ones that pull your wagons and get you from point A to point B? Do you want to see your horses have more personality? Do you want to see the horse just get you from point A to point B?
For me,
it's a circumstance thing. I think I want to see that when it matters. If we're just traveling from point A to point B, then that's what they do. And they become motorcycles. But if you're in a situation where it could have an impact on the encounter, on the session, well, then absolutely they should participate.
And I was going to say, the only time that I've really ever had an interesting horse in role playing was my paladin's called war horse. It was, and it had a backstory. It wasn't a spirit horse that I called from the spirit plane, but when I bonded with it, it was at that point it came from the spirit plane and existed with me. And because of that, it had a story, and I treated it almost like an NPC, like you're saying. Yeah. Because of that, but I think all other horses, it's just like, what's your horse's name? It's horse.
I never even realized until Chad brought it up that hasn't been a part of the game. Yeah. I've never had a name for a horse, I don't think, in game. I mean, we even had in Skies of Glass, we had a GC, a more intelligent animal. And this came...
It did have a personality.
It became part of role-playing, but we never really got in... You know,
we didn't do much with it.
We didn't do anything with it. I never knew it had a personality.
Well, and here's the thing that I would say is, I absolutely agree, it is circumstantial, and the circumstance I would put it upon is two things. One, how attached is the party to the horse? In the same way, you don't necessarily need to put pages and pages of personality into a random shopkeeper. I don't think you need to put it into every animal they encounter.
Yeah.
The second thing I would look at, in addition to how attached they are to it, is how many of them are there? I mean, good heavens, you want the GM to role play with full personality, every NPC in the world, plus four horses, three trained dogs, some guy's owl. I mean,
and a partridge and a pear tree.
Yeah, our current group has 7 to 8 horses.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, and on the same point, I would not want the players to be role playing their horses, personalities as well.
Could you do something simple of give them a name?
On the other hand,
five words of personality and 5 words of description. Here's its color. Here's its basic. Sure. And could that come up from time to time? Sure. But I think certainly the degree of what you'd expect, you just can't expect the GM or the players to give life to every hamster in the world. Brief and closing point here. One thing you might want to consider is the number of animals that you allow in the party, not just for personality reasons, not just for RP reasons, but also purely mechanical reasons, because I have played in games, and as Chad knows, this was many years ago, but we had a thing come up in the game that we started terming Wild Kingdom, which was where a guy had the money and went out and bought and trained so freaking many animals that...
Oh, he was covered in weasels. He had tons of dogs.
Attack boars was his big one. And it got ridiculous. And they dominated everything all the time. And so I think there is a consideration you need to put in there of, you know, if you're not going to let them hire an army of mercenaries, for the same reason, even if the rules allow it, you may want to consider putting a supply and demand cap on the number of attack dogs in the world.
Well, what about every person in the party has one animal? At first, it might sound a little, well, why would that be? Well, what if you're playing the Golden Compass role-playing game? What if you're playing Harry Potter, the role-playing game? What if you're playing something like that?
I think absolutely, yes, you have to deal with that. That's part and parcel of the setting you picked.
But if you're just playing, like, again, let's go, you know, regular D&D, and you just decide, oh, I'm a fighter, you know what, I want to have a dog just because the ranger's got his wolf companion. Oh, and the wizard's got a bird. I mean, if then everybody starts getting an animal, you know, maybe you don't need to do that. You can if you want to. And if your GM is cool with that, that's great. But
Peter Crusaders,
for me, it's kind of, you know, it's more interesting when, you know, it's there are fewer as opposed to everybody's got one. Yeah. Then it's overplayed.
It's been an unusual episode, but miraculously we somehow got there.
I don't think anyone's ever going to hear this episode.
It hasn't been saved yet.
Yeah, it hasn't been saved and exported and edited yet, so we'll see if it actually survives online. But if it does, and you're hearing my voice, a great miracle has happened. A 4th of July miracle. So I want to thank you guys for tuning in. Don't forget to get out there and sign up for the Toff Bitch thing. If you're going to be at Gen Con, at least get in the loop on what these guys are doing. We hope to see you there. And either way, we will catch you next time.
See ya.
Later. Woof.
This has been a production of Fear the Boot, copyright 2010. Listeners are free to use the show in a non-commercial endeavor as long as credit is provided to feartheboot.com. You can find previous episodes and other resources at feartheboot.com. Fear the Boot is also a member of the Pulp Gamer Media Network of shows. You can find other great shows in this network at pulpgamer.com.